What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It has been 111 days since October 7th. In 2025, the population in Gaza fell by about 254,000 people, a 10.6% decline compared with pre-war estimates. This is a result of bombing, starvation, exposure to the elements, not having access to treatment for chronic illnesses or preventable diseases. The Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics said 2025 marked the worst humanitarian and demographic year for Palestinians, driven by Israel's genocide on the Gaza Strip and escalating violations in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. In an interview report, the Bureau said mass killings, forced displacement, and the widespread destruction of basic infrastructure caused serious and long-term damage to population stability, economic and social conditions, and human rights across the Palestinian lands. Citing the Palestinian Ministry of Health, the Bureau said more than 72,000 Palestinians have been murdered since the start of Israel's assault on October 7th, 2023, with 98% of the deaths recorded in Gaza, the highest toll in the history of Israeli attacks on Palestinians. By the end of December 2025, the victims included 18,592 children and about 12,400 women, while about 11,000 people remained missing, and the number of wounded rose to 171,195. Since the start of this iteration of the genocide, which Israel launched with U.S. support, about 100,000 Palestinians were forced to leave Gaza, when nearly 2 million people were displaced from their homes out of a pre-war population of about 2.2 million. In the West Bank, intensified Israeli military operations and settler violence murdered 1,102 Palestinians and wounded 9,034 others since October 2023. A second ceasefire was declared on October 10th, 2025. By the United States to enforce Donald Trump's so-called peace plan. Since October 10th, more than 470 Palestinians have been murdered in repeated violations of the ceasefire by Israel. We begin today's Palestine Post with Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, an organization promoting human rights and democracy in the Middle East and North Africa. She previously led Human Rights Watch MENA division and is a prominent advocate, writer, and commentator on regional justice and accountability. Hoping she's going to join us on camera. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi there. How are you?
I didn't
realize you wanted me on camera, but here I am.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, 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 we do. This all goes on YouTube for folks that absorb information differently. Sarah, Israel said on Monday that the remains of the last hostage in Gaza had been recovered, clearing the way, I'm doing air quotes for those that are listening, for the next phase of the ceasefire that's stopped, again, these are their words, the Israel-Hamas war. In theory, what does that mean? In reality, what do you expect?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that the phase one requirements was for the return of all missing hostages and good faith efforts to locate any bodies of remaining hostages. So the notion that this was the excuse Israel has given over the past several months not to open the Rafah crossing, not to remove its forces from Gaza is implausible. But I'm glad that they have now officially announced that they have located the remains of this last Israeli soldier, apparently near or at the yellow line, which is under Israeli control in the cemetery there. So another curious fact. What they have announced now is that they are planning to open the Rafah border, which has been closed for an extensive period of time, but that Israel will continue to maintain security control and inspection control over what comes in and out of the Rafah border, and is also emphasizing that it is only for the transit of passengers, civilian passengers, as opposed to massive quantities of aid. So it's not clear what exactly they will allow to pass through Rafah. I think the next critical question, of course, is the extent to which Israel is going to agree to withdraw its forces from Gaza. Of course, it's established now a new buffer zone, occupying, physically occupying territory inside Gaza, treating that as a death line if anyone crosses. Two young boys were killed yesterday gathering firewood near this invisible yellow line border. It is where hundreds of Palestinians have been killed since the so-called ceasefire. I think it really remains to be seen.
Thank you, Sarah. I've been covering semi-regularly the moving yellow line and looking at like where it was, right, where it is now, and the ways in which it's being utilized to absorb more and more territory. Can you talk a little bit about how your organization is viewing the yellow line? You mentioned hundreds of folks have been murdered right? I think they probably think, well, this is where it is, and here we are, and then Israel murders them. It reminds me a little bit of the setup of the GNF, where people were going to get food, and this was supposed to be safe crossing, only to meet violence and death.
That's right. Over 1,000 Palestinians were killed at Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so-called aid distribution sites, by Israeli forces under the watch of U.S. military contractors. In some cases, U.S. military contractors themselves killed Palestinians queuing for aid. It was disgusting and atrocious. I think in terms of Gaza and the occupation of Gaza, what's most important to understand is that all of Gaza remains militarily occupied by Israel. Even if Israeli forces aren't present in every square inch of Gaza, as a matter of law, as a matter of practice, practical effect, Gaza is fully occupied by Israeli military forces. They control the borders. They control who comes in and out. They control movement. They exercise their military force at will. And so the notion of the yellow line is also where Israeli military forces are physically present alongside some armed gangs, Palestinian armed gangs that the Israeli government has been arming and funding for an extensive period of time now. Recent reporting in the Wall Street Journal has revealed it. And it really fits into Israel's strategy of divide and conquer, just as it had initially established Hamas and funded and armed Hamas in order to break and divide Fatah and the PLO and the Palestinian Authority. Now it is trying to sow further violence, discord, dissent, division in classic colonial imperial style of divide and conquer by supporting these militias. But the goal and intent of Israel and Israeli officials, and you look at what they say, particularly to their own public, is very clear. They never want to give up Gaza. They want to resettle Gaza. And this has been a longstanding aim of successive Israeli administrations, not just the extremist Likud coalition currently governing. And, you know, dates back to the 1970s when Israeli officials repeatedly said they want all of Gaza. Recent recognition of statehood of Somaliland, the breakaway region of Somaliland, many are speculating, some Israelis are planning and talking about it as a place where Palestinians in Gaza can be deported to. That might seem like an impossibility right now, and a political impossibility right now, but I would not rule it out. Israel has tried numerous test cases of deporting Palestinians to random countries, including deporting a bunch of Palestinian families to South Africa. And I think we have to keep an eye on that. At the same time, there's this massively escalating violence in the West Bank by the Israeli government and its settler paramilitary forces. It tries to shield the violence of these paramilitary groups that are burning houses, setting entire villages on fire, shooting wantonly into communities at farmers as somehow these rogue elements. But it's very, very important to understand that these are paramilitary forces that are secured by the government, that are armed by the government, that are financed by the government. The Israeli government just announced a 550 million shekel budget for Israeli settlers, primarily for their security in the West Bank. So the efforts to continue the destruction and displacement of Palestinians in the West Bank is intensifying, and whatever was achieved in Gaza, I see the West Bank as the next target.
Sarah Leibowitz, and that's actually a really good segue to Trump's and Kushner's presentation in Davos this past week. The plan for a new Gaza, again, air quotes, shimmering towers, hotels, shops built on top of 68 million tons of rubble. Jared Kushner said during his presentation, there is no plan B. There's been no consultation with the Palestinian people, not even the technocratic government, again, air quotes. No conversations about core issues such as property and land rights, let alone justice for war crimes or for where Palestinians will live during construction. The Board of Peace will, of course, oversee all of this. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's a fantastical plan, except for Palestinians. I mean, it is a development plan that sort of pretends Palestinians are not there, sort of pretends the state of Palestine doesn't exist, pretends that Palestinians don't have a right to self-determination, including deciding their governance, deciding their reconstruction. It's no surprise to me that the Board of Peace includes no Palestinians, that the Gaza Executive Board includes no Palestinians, that the Palestinians who were appointed to this subsidiary so-called technocratic committee, you know, by its very name, designated as mere functionaries who follow orders, was created without any consultation with the Palestinian Authority, the State of Palestine, the PLO, the notion that this is going to be remotely successful in addressing the actual problem, which is Israel's ongoing occupation and apartheid rule of Palestinians, Israel's ongoing war crimes against Palestinians, seems quite detached from reality. I am very concerned about the structure of this Board of Peace and Trump's intention to create an empire for himself, with himself as chairman, detached, delinked from his title as president of the United States. I think most people have not noticed that his chairmanship is in his individual personal capacity, and that the United States and the head of state of the United States has a different seat in the Board of Peace. The notion that donors to this Board of Peace are going to be the ones who fund Gaza reconstruction through an entity that is 100% controlled by President Trump, or Mr. Trump, the man, seems extremely sketchy and dangerous.
I had not actually realized that, so thank you, Sarah. That's aha to me. I'm not sure my listeners as well. One of the things that I found interesting or find interesting about what's going on with the so-called border peace is who has been invited to participate, even folks that you would normally think, right, those are from the U.S. government's perspective, Donald Trump's perspective, our enemies, Russia, China, those folks have also been invited to sit at the Border of Peace. Your thoughts about this feels like a really weird word to use in this context, so forgive me, but the inclusivity of the invitations to the Board of Peace.
Well, you know, I don't think inclusivity is the problem per se when you are trying to manage and operate a global multinational organization. China and Russia are obviously members of the United Nations, member states of the United Nations. That's a global entity. We don't exclude countries, except for, you know, very deliberate and rare breaches of the UN Charter. So I don't think that that is in and of itself the problem. I think that what's more telling about this Board of Peace is the extent to which its goals and intentions are completely detached from any concept of international law, of the international rules-based order, of the most basic rules of international governance since World War II, the principal and primary one being the rules prohibiting aggression against other states, except in cases of self-defense. The complete separation from that and the recreation of this as a American persons controlled empirical entity where the only principle is might makes right. In that context, you can see why the inclusion of Belarus or Russia or China makes sense. You know, Trump essentially respects them as powerful, mighty actors with no concern about their status as dictatorships, with no concern about the fact that Russia is the aggressor in the war in Ukraine, that China has savagely destroyed the democratic governance in Hong Kong, and so forth. Those are not issues of concern to Trump. I mean, it is just such an oxymoronic title to call it a board of peace. Yeah. Unless your conception of peace is peace by diktat, peace by oppression, peace by fiat. I think that's more akin to stability and for stability that many authoritarian dictatorships are actually quite good at. But I don't think peace is the right word for it.
Agreed, agreed. You were alluding to this. I'm going to sort of open the road for you to be talk a little bit more specifically. And we heard China say and some other countries say concerns about Trump's intention to utilize the border peace to replace the United Nations, not that the United Nations has been very helpful in Palestine, but that's a different segment. But talk about that, the real possibility that this entity then becomes a sort of pseudo-world governing force. What does that mean for UN reach, power, or utility in the places it's useful?
Well, you know, most of the international entities that exist exist by virtue of consent and mutual cooperation. And the United Nations is sort of the single most important global entity for that kind of global multinational cooperation. It's not the only one. There are obviously many regional blocs that operate that way. And the UN's own position with respect to the Board of Peace is not has not been to oppose it, but to say, fine, the more the merrier. You know, ultimately, however, in order for this Board of Peace to have any power or force, it needs to have access to some kind of military forces, right? The UN Security Council can deploy peacekeeping forces. The UN itself has billions and billions of dollars contributed by states. In order for the Board of Peace to have that kind of viable power and ability to exercise force will require tremendous resources that I don't think $10 billion donated from 10, let's say, member states is going to be sufficient, nor will it give it power to deploy security forces unless, of course, member states somehow volunteer to and then choose to deploy security forces without UN authorization, without UN Security Council authorization. I think that's when we can envision the Board of Peace being in conflict with the UN, the UN Charter, the UN Security Council. But that line's also been crossed in terms of U.S. aggression, for example, in Venezuela most recently. The United States did not seek permission from the U.N. Security Council. The White House didn't even seek permission from Congress to in violation of the U.S. Constitution. So I think it remains to be seen. I myself personally, I'm not opposed per se to a new multilateral entity exclusively focused on peace and conflict resolution. But I don't think the way to remedy the dysfunction and disorder of the UN, and particularly the UN Security Council, is by creating this parallel body that has even less accountability, that has even less transparency, and has even less authority. For many years, there's been discussion about reforming the Security Council, expanding the membership of the Security Council, repealing the veto power that is the single most relevant reason why the Security Council has been so useless in terms of intervening in conflicts and stopping conflicts. Unfortunately, the Biden administration, which had the opportunity to pursue serious reform at the UN Security Council, did not. Instead, chose to continue to insist on the existing Security Council membership with the existing veto powers. So, unfortunately, that was a gravely missed opportunity. And of course, President Trump has no interest in reforming the UN itself.
Right. I would just add to the problems with the existing structure of the so-called Board of Peace that it being led by a man who's currently waging war on his own people. All right. We have just a few minutes left, but Sarah, I don't want to let you go without talking about Iran. You all released a statement with you quoted as saying, quote, the best thing the United States can do to support the Iranian people's movement for freedom is to stay out of it. This is the Iranian people's fight. It will not survive U.S. intervention. You go on to say the U.S. government's record of catastrophic military interventions in the region alongside ongoing military support for regimes that have killed tens of thousands of protesters in their own countries means the U.S. has no credibility to intervene in any way. I, end quote, I absolutely agree with you. Howsomever, we are seeing the United States deploy troops, ships, planes to the Middle East in what looks like setting itself up for active aggression in Iran. Your current thoughts?
I mean, it's very depressing and disturbing that President Trump has broken one of the few promises he made to the American people that I actually supported, which was a promise not to intervene and to start new wars in the world and in the Middle East in particular. Obviously, he has already broken that promise with last year's war in Iran, supporting Israel's war that lasted for 14 days. He's broken that promise in terms of his bombardment of seven countries around the world and the full-on invasion of Venezuela. We were heartened by the delay in launching a war last week when we thought it was imminent. It's very clear that many of his own advisors, particularly Witkoff and Kushner, strongly opposed this military intervention in Iran. And it's very clear that America's closest so-called partners in the Middle East, the dictatorships of Saudi Arabia and other governments in the region, Qatar, as well as Turkey, as well as Lebanon, as well as Egypt, have strongly advised the United States not to start a new war with Iran. Unfortunately, there are some who continue to persist in demanding U.S.-led war in Iran. I am absolutely confident that nothing good will come of such a military intervention, first and foremost for the Iranian people. I fear that the goal of Israel for many, many years, the goal of many in the United States, has simply been to destroy Iran as a force, as a power, just as they did with Iraq, just as they did with Syria. And note, in Syria, under the Obama administration, in the name of supporting a democracy movement, the U.S. government armed violent, unaccountable militias that morphed into ISIS, that morphed into the extremist groups that wreaked utter civil war and terror on the country and have left it the broken shambles of a state that it is today. That is the goal for Iran that I see. That is the objective I believe they would be perfectly happy to see. And I believe it would be catastrophic for the Iranian people, first and foremost.
What role, if any, do you see the international community should play? Because right, we're holding two truths. The U.S., as you just pointed out, with Donald Trump being Donald Trump, and egregious, horrific human rights violations are, in fact, happening against people demanding freedom in Iran. In the perfect world, how would the world respond?
Well, the response has to be consistent and principled, regardless of where we are seeing these kinds of horrors by a dictatorship inflicted on its own population. The number one rule is the consistency in the approach. You cannot, on the one hand, arm, aid, and abet Israel while it slaughters over 70,000 Palestinians in Gaza in an outright genocide. You cannot continue to arm the dictatorship in Egypt, which massacred over 1,000 protesters in a single day with U.S. backing and support, while and British support and French support. After this massacre, President Macron in France gave General Sisi the Medal of Honor, France's highest award, after the massacre of protesters. So it just doesn't work to single out one state for its violence against protesters and decide that's where you're going to take action, because you lack the credibility to do so. You lack the legitimacy to do so. We have multilateral institutions. We have the United Nations that is empowered to take action. Those are the measures that can be taken in terms of providing accountability, in terms of putting pressure on the Iranian government. But again, it cannot be done in isolation. And I think that's such a hard idea for people to get their heads around. Yes, we can't fix every problem at the same time, nor should we try. But we must establish a record of multilateral support for protesters, multilateral support for democracy and human rights that, you know, at least is consistent across the Middle East.
Sarah Leo Whitson, the topics have not been joyful, but it has been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.